Hi, welcome back to Your Best Friends Podcast. I am your host and best friend, Aurora, and I want to introduce you to your new best friend, Micheline.
Hi, how's everybody doing?
So Micheline is a therapist. I came across you on my For You page on TikTok and started following you on Instagram. And I feel like I know that TikTok is not the first platform to really have a lot of therapists and mental health professionals on it, but I feel like I've noticed it a lot more on TikTok than I have on other platforms. And I really want to get into that. But first, I'd love to have you kind of introduce yourself and tell everyone how you became a therapist, what drew you to that, and all of that.
Sure. So my name is Micheline. I am a therapist in Orlando, Florida. I own my own private practice. I've been in my own private practice for about 3 years now. And I initially became a therapist. I don't have like an exact answer to that. It's one of those things that my professor said, therapy is a profession that kind of chooses you. You don't choose it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I grew up, my parents were Middle Eastern. I was born in another country in Syria, and I moved to Orlando when I was 8 years old. So I experienced a lot of trauma from the moving. I experienced the third culture challenges, which, you know, I didn't really have a home. So like when I was here in Orlando, you know, I was the Arab child. And then when I was in Syria, when we would visit, I was the American child. So, you know, home felt kind of, I was always kind of searching for who I was. And I always really had an interest in psychology. And obviously with the Middle Eastern culture and American culture combined, I experienced a lot of challenges in regards to that and bullying growing up. So I just always learned how to relate to people really well at an early age. I was the front therapist. So that was, you know, I developed an interest in psychology at a very young age. And then after I graduated college, I had a lot of self-esteem issues. So I didn't even think I could make it to graduate school. So I actually just didn't apply to graduate school for 4 years. And then I went through another traumatic event with a relationship. And that relationship ended, and a therapist helped me get through it. And that's when I realized that, hey, like this is, I can't believe she did that for me. I want to do that for other people. So I ended up going to therapy school and getting over my fears and just applying and all of that. But that's the basic, like shortened sense of the story of why I became a therapist.
I love that you said that it finds you, because so when I was in college, I was originally a psychology major and then switched because it just, well, truly, it was a little bit too much science for me at the beginning. I had a really hard time passing my biology class, so I switched to English. But I love that you said that you wanted to be able to help people in the same way that you were helped, because I think, yeah. There's obviously a lot of stigma around therapy. I feel like less so than there used to be, but I remember being in college and I had gone to therapy right before I went to work, and a coworker had asked me, I was like writing in one of my journals in the back room before my shift started because I was, you know, fresh out of therapy, wanted to write down what I was thinking about. Mm-hmm. And someone came up and asked me what I was doing, and I very like offhandedly just mentioned like, oh, you know, my therapist wants me to write XYZ throughout the week. And he got really like weird about it and was like, oh, so you're in therapy. And I remember I straight up was like, I think everybody should go to therapy. I think anyone can benefit from it. I think if you are the kind of person that's like, no, I definitely don't need therapy, then like, I mean, if you truly think you don't have anything to gain from it, good for you, I guess. But like, I think that therapy isn't just about fixing what's broken, although that is a big part of it, that it also has, there's just so much more to it, and it doesn't deserve the stigma that it gets. So I'd love to talk about anxiety, because that's kind of one of your specialties, right?
Yes, anxiety and complex PTSD.
So what are some ways that as a therapist you have noticed that anxiety manifests itself? Because I know that it can be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so anxiety can be different for everybody. The way it manifests depends on a lot of factors, where it's coming from, you know, what support system you have. So mostly in my practice, I see people with the worried thoughts, with the catastrophizing is one of the mental filters we talk about that is really prominent with anxiety. So that's basically when you, something's happening and you automatically, your brain automatically goes to that worst case scenario. So I'll give you an example. One time, and I suffer with anxiety, so like this is personal to me too as an anxiety therapist. My husband was late coming home from work for like 30 minutes. And I thought his car was in the garage and I thought he had ridden his bike to work that day. And so I looked and the bike wasn't there. And I'm like, oh man, it's what's happening. I'm calling him. He's not answering. Automatically, my brain goes to, he got run over by a car. He got hit by a car. He fell. And I start calling him, texting him. He's not responding. I called all the police departments. I called all the hospitals. I had a major panic attack. And finally, he arrives home like 45 minutes later. And he's like, my phone died. he's like, I was fine. Like, you know, you need to calm down. Like, what's going on? But that's basically, you know, the worry thought, the catastrophizing that we go through. And that's a very, very common one. I see physical manifestations of anxiety. So a lot of, you know, gastrointestinal issues, a lot of muscle tension, particularly in the jaw and the shoulders and the neck. I see relationship challenges, obviously, because with, you know, anxiety, you can start to really hyper-focus and like notice little subtle changes in your partner's facial expressions. And even if they're upset about work, you might start again mind reading or fortune telling or catastrophizing why they're upset. And usually it's like, oh, maybe they're upset at me. What did I do? Why didn't they call me back, you know, 30 minutes ago? But then you have, those are the more common ones. But then you have, you know, obviously more severe, you know, anxiety where, you know, it kind of goes into OCD and, you know, the higher levels of where the functioning's impaired a lot more.
Right. Because something that I didn't know for a long time is that a lot of those different mental illnesses kind of lead into each other. Like you said, that like OCD isn't just, OCD is one of those ones that has just the worst stigmas around it. And it's, people throw the word around for all sorts of reasons when it's really a very serious condition, but it is, you know, similar to anxiety in that way where it's, I have a few friends that have really bad OCD and it's, and I can relate to them on a lot of levels up to a certain point. And then, cause I do have really bad anxiety, but I'm grateful that it's, there are some things that I am fine with, that I leave my house and I'm usually pretty confident that my doors are locked and I didn't leave anything plugged in and, you know, those sort of things. But I, as you're talking about those scenarios, I was 100% just like nodding and relating because I do that exact same thing. And what's funny is I didn't know for a long time that anxiety could manifest itself physically. And so when I was in college, I got really, really sick and had no idea why, and ended up going to a bunch of doctors and MRIs and all sorts of stuff just to find out that it was anxiety that was making me so sick. And it was almost embarrassing because I was like, well, I've spent all this money going to doctors telling me like, oh, I don't know what's wrong with you, go to this guy. And I was like, just to have it be my brain like playing tricks on me and telling me that, et cetera. So, mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite tips for people who are dealing with anxiety and panic and like kind of de-escalation, especially when it comes to that catastrophic thinking?
Sure. So again, it depends on the person. Where is the anxiety coming from? Because we all have anxiety. We all have anxiety. Let's start there. Mm-hmm. We all have mental health and we all have anxiety, and it's all, you know, it's the level of it. So if somebody's coming to me with severe anxiety, I really want to get the body to feel safe first, because when we are in a state of panic, when we're in a state of heightened anxiety, not normal levels of anxiety, like when we have an exam coming up, but you know, that physical, like you said, when you were in college and that physical manifestation of it, what's happening is in our bodies, we're really going into fight or flight mode. So it's a perceived threat. There's probably not an actual threat. In some cases there are, like if you're in an abusive relationship, for instance, then I can't say it's a perceived threat. It's possibly an actual threat, which makes things a lot harder, because then we're kind of working on how to ground ourselves in the relationship and trying to get out, rather than, you know, something that's not happening in cases like with generalized anxiety disorder, where everything is really threatening, but there's no really, you can't put a finger on like what's going on, like why. And so one of the things that we start with somebody who has those physical manifestations, or somebody that is in a place where they're not in an abusive relationship, not in the danger in the current moment, then we work on bringing safety back to the body. So we start working on grounding techniques. So the 5-4-3-2-1 tool. So that's when you look around the room and you notice five things that you see. And I usually tell people, don't just like name objects off really quickly, because that's not the point. The point is to really engage with those objects. So let's say I'm looking at an orchid right now. Okay, I can look at it and maybe I notice something about it that I haven't noticed before. So you do that with five different things, and the things can be really soothing. That's really helpful if you look at like a blanket or a teddy bear, or you know, something that you love, or maybe something unique that you haven't seen before. And then you want to do four things that you can touch. And with the touch, again, be very intentional with the touch. So notice textures, notice the temperature, notice how it feels when you touch it. Is it smooth? Is it rough? And then three things you can hear. So closing your eyes and really focusing on the sounds in the room and maybe outside of the room. Then two things you can smell, and that could be like an essential oil, a perfume, an air freshener, maybe the smell of fresh grass if you're outside. And then one thing you can taste. And so that could be like a hard candy or coffee or a sip of water. And that's what we call, that's one of the most common popular grounding tools. Because what happens again with anxiety, it's that perceived threat of fight or flight. So our brain thinks that we're in danger. Our prefrontal cortex, which is in our forehead area, thinks we're in danger. And so it shuts off logical thinking and it just wants to escape. When we do 5-4-3-2-1, what we end up doing is we end up reminding ourselves that we're actually in a safe environment. So although the intention of it isn't to remove anxiety completely, it's a mindful practice that helps us slowly over time with practice have a reduction in our anxiety. There's also one more thing for the thought processing of it, because that's the physical processing of it. For the thought processing part, like with catastrophizing, one tip that I tell people is there's this tool, it's called diffusion, and it comes from acceptance and commitment therapy. And diffusion pretty much means unhooking or detaching from your thoughts. Oftentimes with anxiety, we are believing what we're thinking and it makes things worse. And so the point of this is to say, recognize and acknowledge to yourself that that's a thought, and thoughts are not fact. So one of the tools is saying, I'm having the thought. So for instance, in the example I gave you earlier with my husband, I could have said, I'm having the thought that my husband got in a car accident. I'm having the thought that he's not okay. I'm having the thought that, you know, I'm never going to see him again. And by just simply stating that I'm having the thought before each of those overthinking or anxious thoughts, it helps, again, our brain remember that those are thoughts and there's a potential for them not to be true. So those are just two that have worked really well with clients.
No, that makes a lot of sense, especially the, I feel like, bringing awareness to the thought is so powerful, because you really are, I mean, because everything's a thought process. And so really bringing that awareness to it can be so helpful. So Another thing that you talk a lot about on social media, and you said that you specialize in, is complex trauma. So I'd love to have you explain a little bit the difference between like complex PTSD and PTSD and kind of all of that.
Sure. So PTSD typically happens after we have a one-time traumatic event. So let's say a car accident, or a significant breakup, or, you know, it's a one-time thing, or any sort of abuse that might happen that happens one time and done. So we end up having the hypervigilance, we end up having the nightmares, the flashbacks, and the flashbacks typically in regular PTSD are visual flashbacks. So more of the reliving of that event that happened over and over again. With CPTSD, the C standing for complex, it's called complex because of the chronic, it's chronic, and it's usually not necessarily one type of trauma. It's usually multiple traumas. So let's say, and this is the more like, it's like not understood as well, because there's some people that will invalidate their own experience because they don't recognize that, you know, certain little things added over time, what we call little T traumas, can add up to equal a gigantic trauma, or, you know, more than, you know, what a gigantic trauma could be. So don't ever judge yourself or say that my trauma isn't valid, because some of the things that can lead to complex trauma include growing up in poverty, growing up with emotionally unavailable parents, watching loved ones die, chronic illness of loved one or yourself, multiple abusive relationships, physical, sexual, you know, all types of abuse chronic over time can lead to complex trauma. Being bullied, I don't know if I said that already, but being bullied for a long period of time can lead also to complex trauma. And what differs between in the symptoms, they have a lot of the similar symptoms in terms of hypervigilance and, you know, the depression and the anxiety, but the hypervigilance is a little bit different. The flashbacks, they're not necessarily visual in nature. They're what we call emotional flashbacks. So I don't know if you've ever been in a relationship or in a situation where all of a sudden you just got really sad out of nowhere, or like really flooded with emotion. Usually that's what we call an emotional flashback, because it's not necessarily the event that caused that. It's the memory that you have of something in the past that happened that caused that. So let's say a boyfriend or a girlfriend of yours doesn't call you back in 30 minutes. It's not necessarily that in that moment that's what caused that intense emotional reaction, but it could be what happened in the past that led that when somebody didn't call you after 30 minutes, what did that mean for you in that moment? And so we see a lot of low self-esteem, body image too, but like self-image issues with CPTSD. The flashbacks, again, are emotional in nature. It becomes really hard to, we see a lot of dissociation happening. So that's when you feel like you're out of your body, you're not really present. You kind of have all these triggers all around. There's a bunch of perceived threats. Whereas with PTSD, it's usually like a one type of trigger, right? So like a war veteran will hear a firework and it'll remind them of like a gunshot, whereas with CPTSD it could be literally anything. It could be a scent, a name, a just the way a situation makes you feel. So it's a lot more complex.
Yeah, definitely a lot more complex. So what are you did a video recently on TikTok about how trauma can be held in the body. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that a little bit more and kind of talk to me about how the body holds on to that and how it manifests?
Well, again, it's the same as I was mentioning in terms of like anxiety. There's something called polyvagal theory, which is like a whole nother episode for that's very complicated. But basically to put it, when we go through traumatic experience, let's talk CPTSD or regular trauma, the one-time trauma, you go into fight or flight, right? A tiger's chasing you. If we were like back in the day, tiger's chasing you, you automatically go to fight or flight. You either are going to run away from the tiger or you're going to fight the tiger. And if there's no escape, you're going to freeze and just kind of shut down bodily functions and, you know, hopefully have a less painful death. And nowadays, you know, we're not in caves, we're not being chased by tigers, but we're still under threat in a lot of circumstances. And sometimes our body doesn't get a chance to regulate itself after the trauma happens. So let's say that you're in a chronic abusive relationship, then you're constantly under threat day in and day out. And so what ends up happening is you're not fighting, you're not running away, you're kind of going into that freeze mode, shutdown mode. Your body is going into a place where it's not functioning the way it needs to function. So you have reduced oxygen levels to vital organs, you're having reduced immune response, you're having so it's not like when people say, oh, so does that mean that my physical symptoms are in my head? No, it's actually very physical. It's actually very much 100% in your body. But why it's being caused, as opposed to it being caused by like a medical condition that is like, let's say like a cancer diagnosis or something happening, it's actually being caused by all of these responses that are happening because our body isn't functioning appropriately because it's under threat. So when we don't go, when we're under that chronic state of stress for that long, our nervous system doesn't get the opportunity to regulate itself, which then leads to all of that tension and contracting all over our bodies. So the remedy to that is obviously to start regulating that nervous system with, again, bringing safety back to the body, eliminating what we see as perceived threats and reminding ourselves that we're safe, the grounding tools and the thought processing part of it as well.
Today's episode is sponsored by Kitsch. The past few months being at home, I decided it was time to change up my hair care routine. I've been wanting to find a bar alternative for my shampoo and conditioner that isn't stripping for my hair. And I figured if it doesn't turn out okay, at least I'm stuck at home, right? Well, I really didn't need to worry about that. I decided to take the 5-day Kitsch challenge and am blown away by the results. Their shampoo and conditioner bars are more friendly for the environment than a traditional shampoo and conditioner. And because of the concentrated formula, you're not paying for a bottle that's actually 90% water. Yeah, you heard that right. A lot of traditional shampoos are up to 90% water. My hair looks healthier, feels softer, and looks shinier. And because it's a zero-waste product, it's something I feel really good about. You can check them out on Instagram at mykitsch, on TikTok at kitsch, and at mykitsch.com. That is spelled K-I-T-S-C-H. That is so interesting to me. I think it's truly amazing how our mind and our bodies are so connected, and it really goes to show that your mind is so much more powerful than we give it credit to. And it really is, although it's difficult to be in that situation where you are holding so much trauma in your body, it's also incredible to think about how much your body's just trying to keep you safe from those threats. So I kind of want to talk a little bit more about social media. So you have over 800,000 followers on TikTok. Have you noticed that with having such a large platform on social media, has that changed the way that you practice at all?
No, not the way that I practice. Absolutely not. I've always, I've always had my same tools and techniques. So in terms of practice with my clients, no. If anything, it's probably maybe just strengthened it a little bit more, just because when people ask you questions on social media, sometimes your clients don't ask you those questions. Maybe they're shy or they're, worried about it. But then on social media, someone asks you something, you're like, oh, that's good. I don't know. Let me research that real quick. And so you do research. So it kind of makes you a better therapist, in my opinion, in terms of, because now I have like all of this stuff that I know is important to people that I may not be aware of when I'm just working with my clients alone. So it hasn't changed how I practice, but it has broadened my horizons, I guess you could say.
So what would you say are some advantages to following therapists and mental health professionals on social media?
Yeah, so advantages, well, true psychoeducation. So what people don't what people don't realize is that a big, huge part of therapy is what we call psychoeducation. And psychoeducation refers to exactly what you and I were just talking about and all the stuff that you've seen me post on social media. So it's, you know, why does this happen? What are the signs? What are the symptoms? What are, so that's why you see me constantly doing like three mm-hmm. signs or three reasons or three, you know, because a lot of times awareness is a huge, huge part of therapy. It's really developing like the why and figuring out the how. And once we have that, yes, a therapist can definitely help you process all of that, but not everybody has access. Not everybody has insurance. Not everybody has the funds. Not everybody has, even in their, some states, some cities don't have many therapists. Some people, if they're young adults or teens, don't have parents that don't believe in therapy. Maybe somebody's significant partner doesn't, you know, want them to go into therapy. So I think there's a lot of value in, you know, getting information when you don't have access. And if you do have access and you're in therapy, it's a great reminder of what you're supposed to be doing, or hey, do your therapy homework, or, you know, keeping that on your mind, kind of like going to the gym and then watching workout videos when you get home or something. It kind of just reinforces all of that information that you're gaining anyway.
Yeah, I think that's so true. I will see myself, I'll see a video come up on my For You page and I'll be like, oh, that reminds me that I wanted to bring this up to my therapist in my next session, or it reminds me to change something or do something that I have been, that my therapist has been telling me to do. I feel like it just kind of reinforces that because you're seeing it outside of that structured, like, mm-hmm. hour that you are talking with your therapist. So one question that I had was, do you think that having this prevalence of videos from, about mental health, do you feel like that has caused more people to self-diagnose?
Yeah, so self-diagnosis is a huge thing. And there's a lot of times when I'll put them, I'll forget half the time, but a lot of times I'll make a note, like, please do not self-diagnose, especially when it comes down to things that are like high functioning anxiety, which is not an official diagnosis, or high functioning depression, which isn't an official diagnosis. None of, there's so much that goes into diagnosing, and the diagnosis isn't the end all be all of things. You know, you don't have to have what the DSM calls a diagnosis for your pain to be valid. And so I think it's really important for people to know that. Having said that, I think there's also a lot of validation in seeing yourself in a diagnosis, especially for people who have been told maybe they're crazy, or they, you know, they don't have problems, and, you know, that they shouldn't be feeling so sad. Seeing that those symptoms fit in with what might be a diagnosis can also be very validating and freeing to know that they're not alone and that they're not, you know, crazy. And so I think, yeah, with you know, every positive, there's probably some sort of negative. But as long as people know that, you know, self-diagnosis isn't, what are you going to do? It's not going to be a bad thing. You know, it's not going to, you want to say you have 10 different disorders. Okay, that's not going to harm you. You know, I think it does when you start to use them as like a crutch. But as long as people are doing that, maybe they are self-diagnosing, but maybe they're self-diagnosing to go to their doctor. And like you said, mm-hmm. I need to bring up this to my therapist next time. I think that's very healthy. I think that starts conversations. I think our medical system hasn't exactly been the best with doctors in terms of, like,
yeah,
you know, we have the WebMD and all of that, which people can fall down the rabbit hole of. But I think if you're a good doctor or a good therapist and your client comes to you and says, I saw a video or I read an article and they mentioned these symptoms and I feel like I have this, then if you don't shut it down, you don't want to shut it down. You want to explore that with your client. You want to open the conversation up, and it could lead to something really important. So I think there's good and there's bad, but you know, I guess it depends. It really depends. Hard question to answer.
Yeah. Well, I feel like anytime I see a video like that, I do see so many comments of people being like, oh, so I have ADHD, or oh, so I have this. And I think that is important to be like, well, you know, you can't say just from watching this one video if you have that, but it gives you the opportunity to explore that. It gives you the opportunity to go to a professional and say, I watched this video and they talked about bipolar disorder and I have a lot of those things that they talked about. Can we talk about that? Can we explore that? Because a video on TikTok can't diagnose you, but I think that bringing that awareness is really important, especially in a society that has had so much stigma around mental illness and mental health issues. And I honestly find it so refreshing to see so many videos bringing awareness, and just to have that be such a regular part of my social media experience now, I think is so reassuring. And it honestly, the way that I viewed therapy like a decade ago to now, or even like 5 years ago, is so vastly different. And I feel like a big part of that is social media.
Yeah.
So I want to, before we wrap up, get into a few questions. So I posted on Instagram asking people to send in questions. And we did hit a lot of them, because a lot of people had questions about anxiety and trauma. So one question that someone wanted to know was, what is your favorite part about being a therapist?
One of my favorite, oh man, that's a hard question, because I literally was talking to my mom about this yesterday and I was saying how I don't feel like it's a job. I feel like it's doing something good for the world. It's not one of those jobs where you wake up and you're like, oh, I have to go to work again. It's like you're making a difference and you're helping people be their best selves. So I love the relationships that I build. I absolutely can say I love every single one of my clients. And, you know, it's a different kind of relationship, but it's so rewarding to just see people come in with maybe hopelessness and feeling like they, you know, have no option but to maybe end their lives sometimes. And, you know, a few months later, seeing them starting to appreciate even bits and pieces of their lives, even if it's not like a total change, but just slightly seeing more hope in their life.
No, I think that's beautiful. And I think that really just goes back into what you were saying in the beginning, is that you love that opportunity to help people and to, yeah, show them those, that there is more to life and that they can, like, they don't have to be trapped by their mental illness. So we did get a question specifically about intrusive thoughts and how to kind of deal with those, getting rid of those. I will assume that it probably is similar to those grounding techniques that you talked about earlier, but yeah, so kind of what would you say about that?
So intrusive thoughts, that's a popular question, and it's with intrusive thoughts, obviously they're usually not pleasant, right? They're usually icky thoughts. They're usually, I mean, you can have thoughts about stabbing somebody and when you're not like a harmful person, right? And so you can have about like driving your car off the road, and that's when people, or even intrusive thoughts that we might deem inappropriate in, you know, the social world and in normal everyday life. But knowing that we're not going to act on those, that those are thoughts, right? So like most of the people that have intrusive thoughts have zero want to carry out those thoughts. And I think what's so scary about them and what isolates people is that they think, I shouldn't be having these thoughts. Now, the moment you tell yourself, I shouldn't be having these thoughts, stop the thoughts, guess what's going to happen? Those thoughts are just going to flood in even more. I have a video on TikTok that I tell people for the next 30 seconds, do not think about elephants. And, you know, pause the video, yeah, whatever you do, don't, and all you can do is think of elephants. And so you don't want to tell your intrusive thoughts to go away. What you want to do is recognize them as thoughts. They are thoughts. They cannot harm you. They don't say anything about you. They don't make you a good or a bad person. They are thoughts. And so when you can pay attention to them for a minute, just look at them and notice and say, I'm having the thought that I want to run my car over to the side of the road, or I want to stab my friend, or whatever, you know, whatever intrusive thought is happening, and recognize and say again that I'm having the thought thing that I talked about at the beginning, and recognize that that has nothing to do with who you are as a person, and that, you know, it's not going to make you behave in any sort of way. And then redirecting your attention to something pleasant or something that you actually want to do. And each time that thought comes in, which it will, instead of focusing on pushing it away, focus on noticing and redirecting, noticing and redirecting. Over time, when you don't give it so much power by saying, I shouldn't have it, go away, then it naturally starts declining.
That makes a lot of sense that you, because you are just going to focus on it. And I think that's natural for us to kind of fixate on that and be like, oh my God, I'm having this thought that's horrible. And you kind of obsess over it. And I think that you can very quickly like spiral with that thought where it just goes places and you get, and it can be so like upsetting. And so I also think it's important for people to know that like intrusive thoughts happen to everybody. Obviously there are some people who get them a lot more frequently, but you can be doing anything and just all of a sudden have an intrusive thought, and that doesn't give you a specific diagnosis, but it also doesn't mean that it has to like take over your life. That you can, it obviously is not like an immediate fix, but there are things that you can do to help yourself kind of get through that and stop them from happening as frequently. Okay, so the last question that I wanted to touch on that we didn't discuss already was just kind of, you briefly mentioned high-functioning depression, and kind of in the sense of that's something that people self-diagnose a lot. No, you're totally fine. No, you're totally fine. Okay, so I'll just repeat that. So I would love to have you just kind of explain a little bit what that is. So you said that it's not really like a technical diagnosis, but I'd love to hear a little bit about that kind of right before we wrap up.
Sure. So there's a couple of different diagnoses for depression. There's major depressive disorder, but then there's something called persistent depressive disorder, which is, you know, over 2 years, and you're kind of living life. Typically, it's not as intense as the major, but it's still pretty intense. And then you have something that maybe with that in itself, persistent depressive disorder could also be on a spectrum, you know. So it's really where you've lost, you're not necessarily laying in bed all day, crying all day, having crying spells, but you just feel kind of meh. You know, you're blah, you're not interested in many things anymore. Maybe you are more sensitive to certain things. Maybe you're just not interested, not creative. You're kind of just on autopilot. Let's put it that way. You're on autopilot. You're just going through the motions, but you don't really feel much enjoyment out of life. And it's really hard for you. Maybe you're exhausted all the time, and it's things that may seem easy, like cleaning your room may seem overwhelming, but you know, you tend to minimize it because you say, well, I'm not having suicidal thoughts, and I'm not, you know, crying at everything, and I can still go to work. And so am I depressed? But you know, again, it's on a spectrum and it's so different. So I think it's really important that if you do feel a change in your life, if you feel like you were one way and then you've changed, and I'm sure a lot of us have changed during this pandemic and this year.
Yes.
Talk to someone, ask the questions. So that way you can get the help that you need when you need it.
I love that. I think we so often just, especially because it's often a gradual thing. It's not like you wake up one day and you just no longer enjoy your life. And so I think because it can be so gradual, people just, yeah, they brush it off, and they let it go on long enough that it gets to a really bad spot. And so I really think that's honestly the perfect place to end on, is just talk to someone and get the help that you need if you feel like you need it, if you feel like you've noticed changes, if you're no longer enjoying things.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell everyone where they can find you on social media and all of that.
Sure. So my TikTok account, it's a little bit of a strange name. It's my nickname growing up, but you can find me at MASHMUSHE. So Mashmushe, MASHMUSHE. And on Instagram, I am known as Serene Counseling, SEREIN. Sorry, not counseling. Serene Micheline, SEREIN Micheline, MICHELINE.
Perfect. And I will put links to that in the show notes so people can find you more easily. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about this. I feel like right now with the pandemic and quarantine and everything's just been like an upheaval this year. And I feel like especially with the holidays coming up, I feel like that just brings up so much more emotion and trauma and stuff like that. So I think that this is perfectly timed. So thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today. And I will talk to you all next week.